Well, a pastor was walking down the street and he saw a group of boys aged between 10 and 12 standing around a dog. And he thought that they were going to hurt the dog, and so he yelled out to them, "Boys, what are you doing to that dog?" And as he got closer, they said to him, "Nothing, sir, we're just looking at him. He's a stray and we want to take him home, but only one of us can take him home, so we decided that whoever would tell the biggest lie would be able to take the dog home with them." And the minister was outraged by this. The biggest lie? Don't you know that the Bible says that it's a sin to tell a lie? And so he gave them a 10-minute sermon on why lying is a sin. And he concluded by saying, "When I was a boy, I never told a lie." And the little boys looked at each other and they said, "All right, you win. You can have the dog." Well, today I want to talk a little bit about lying and deception and excuses. Something that even we as Christians engage in a little more often than we would care to admit. People have developed the fine art of excuse making. Now, you might wonder what the difference is between a lie and an excuse, and the answer is not all that much. An excuse has been defined as the skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. And why do we often offer excuses rather than reasons? Well, it's because we don't want to do something, isn't it? A reason is what we offer when we're unable to do something, and an excuse is what we offer when we don't want to do something and we want to get out of it. And it's been said that he who excuses himself accuses himself. But the bottom line is we all know an excuse when we hear one, don't we? And we think, well, we're not buying that. We may not say it, but we think, well, I don't really believe this person. You know, the typical student's excuse, one, of course, that I never use, is, "Sorry, I didn't hand my assignment in on time because my dog ate my homework." Has there ever been a dog on earth in human history that has literally eaten someone's homework? But seriously, the problem of lying and deception and excuses has become far too common in our culture. According to a report by People Checking Solutions, 71% of employers have encountered lies on the CV of people that have wanted jobs. They've increased the time they spent on their previous job. They've exaggerated their accomplishments. They've overstated the size of the department they manage. They've said that they had 4 degrees when they hadn't. They inflated the previous salary that they had. In 2007, 50% of UK employers lost money by withdrawing job offers or dismissing someone for misrepresenting themselves. And of course, you only have to watch a series of The Apprentice on the television to see how much misrepresentation takes place in the candidates' CVs. A study that was conducted by the University of Massachusetts found that 60% of people lied at least once during a 10-minute conversation. 60%. And on average, people told 2 or 3 lies. We lie about our age. We lie about our income. We lie about our accomplishments. We lie in order to escape embarrassment. You know, some of the most commonly used excuses are, "Well, I wasn't feeling very well. The check's in the post. I was only kidding." According to the book Excuses and Lies, Lines for All Occasions, here are some of the top lies. "I will be ready in a minute." Well, that's one for the ladies, isn't it? "I'll be ready in a minute." "I will do it in a minute." That's one for the men, isn't it? I've never heard that joke before. Of course I'm listening. Nothing is wrong. You look great. And yes, dear. Have you ever said some of those things? Now, come on. Don't lie. It's easy to stretch the truth a little bit, isn't it? And then there are excuses. And we've all heard them, and maybe we've used many of them ourselves. The first excuse that we know of course, happened in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, and when God confronted Adam and said, "Did you eat of this tree that I didn't ask you to eat of?" Instead of just saying, "Yes, I did," Adam said, "Well, actually, it was the woman that you gave me. It's her fault. That's why I did it." And of course, that was an excuse. And then the second excuse was given by Eve when she said, "Well, it was the serpent that tricked me." In other words, it was the devil that made me do it. And of course, we know the old joke, don't we? That then the serpent didn't have a leg to stand on. One of my favourite excuses in the Bible is what Aaron said to Moses over in Exodus chapter 32. Moses was called by God to go up Mount Sinai and receive the Ten Commandments, and Aaron was left in charge of the Israelites. And the people grew frustrated, and so they said to Aaron, "We don't know where Moses is, and we want gods to be able to worship." And instead of discouraging them, this is what Aaron said. This is Exodus 32 and beginning in verse 2. "Take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me." And so all of the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron. And he took what they handed him, and he made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. And then they said, "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt." And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord." And meanwhile, on Mount Sinai, Moses is still bathing in the glory of God, watching the finger of the Lord write the commandments on tablets of stone. And they hear this noise in the camp. And Joshua, who is accompanying Moses, thinks it sounds like a war has started down there. But as they get closer to see what's going on, it's the biggest party of all time. And Moses sees the Israelites dancing naked before a golden calf. And he confronts Aaron and says in verse 22, "Do not be angry, my Lord. You know how prone these people are to do evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who go before us.' As for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what's happened to him. Though I told them, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry to take it off,' and then they gave me the gold, and I threw it into the fire, and guess what? Out came this calf." Now, I've heard some excuses. But that takes the biscuit, doesn't it? "I just happened to throw it in, and out came this calf. What could I do?" Well, Jesus knows something about excuses. Matthew 22. Let's read the passage again, beginning in verse 1. "Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, 'The kingdom of heaven is like a king who has prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused. Then he sent some more servants and said, 'Tell those who have been invited that I have prepared my dinner. The oxen has been fattened, has been butchered, everything is ready, come to the wedding banquet.' But they paid no attention and went off, one to his field, another to his business. The rest seized his servants, mistreated them and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. And then he said to his servants, 'The wedding banquet is ready, but those that I invited did not deserve to come. So go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone that you find.' So the servants went out into the streets and gathered all the people that they could find, the bad as well as the good, the people we've sung about, the vagabonds. Doesn't matter. Whoever they could find. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. So here's the parable. The king is throwing a wedding banquet for his son. Now this is a royal wedding that's being spoken of here. It's like Prince William or Prince Harry getting married. It would have been a feast of all feasts. To be a pre-invited guest to a wedding like this was the greatest of all honours. The event was not merely the meal. It was something that would have gone on for weeks. You would have been invited to stay in the palace of the king. No expense would have been spared. The tables would have been decorated. The finest chefs would have been working overtime. The most talented of musicians would have been well rehearsed. This would have been an amazing thing to be at. Now, the protocol in that culture would have been to extend two invitations. The first invitation would be, would you come and would you RSVP? Just like we do today. Would you let us know that you're coming along? And the reason they would ask that is the same reason we would ask today. How many places to set at the table? How much food shall we lay on? And so on. So the invitation went out. And if you're not able to come, you say so at that point. No, I can't make it. But once you've accepted the first invitation, it would have been a really big deal if you didn't show up when the second invitation came. Far better not to have accepted it than at the last minute not show up. Now, as our story unfolds, we're seeing people that are rejecting the second invitation. They've already said they'll come, but it seems like it's a bit of a joke to them. Verse 5 says, but they paid no attention and went off. In the New King James it says, but they made light of it and went their ways. The Greek here means they were careless. They were neglecting. They didn't have any concern for what they were being asked to go to. So they just sort of laughed it off. No, I'm not going to bother. The whole idea of the banquet was a little bit of a joke to them. And they offered their excuses. Let's have a look at the parallel chapter in Luke 14. Because here we find out the actual excuses that these people gave. Luke 14, and beginning in verse 16. Jesus said, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. And at the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, I've just bought a field. I must go and see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. And still another said, I just got married. Well, I can't come. And when you think about it, they aren't even good lies, are they? A man bought a field without looking at it first. Another bought 5 oxen without testing them first. And the third guy's classic. I got married, so you know my life is now over. Don't even call me to do anything now. I can't come. All three would have known what an important occasion this was, and they would have been aware of how much time and money had been spent on it. They'd already accepted the gracious invitation, and to turn it down now was insulting. And why did they do it? Because they're thinking of themselves. The first two excuses have to do with material things or possessions, and the third has to do with affection. And it's these two things, possessions and affections, that cover virtually every excuse for why people say no to God. They become more important than God is. I mean, just look at these excuses for a moment. Verse 18. The first said, I've just brought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me. Now, was this chap a complete idiot or what? He bought a field without looking at it. Now, some people do that with houses, don't they? But it's not the wisest move, because estate agents can be very creative with their descriptions. So when you read something like, in need of some redecoration, it often means it needs a complete remodernization. Or when you read it has a sea view, what they don't add is if you've got a pair of binoculars. Or when it says tastefully maintained, they don't add if you were living in the 1970s. Now here's the reality of the situation. Back in the days when Christ told this parable, buying a piece of property was not unlike today. It was a long and a complicated process. A purchaser would have had many opportunities to examine the land that they were buying. So to say I've bought a piece of land and now I'm going to actually go and see what it's like wasn't true. The man said it because he didn't want to go to the banquet. But interestingly, in the original language, there's a politeness about his excuse. So at least he was nice about it. Oh, please excuse me. I'm so sorry. But I bought this piece of land and I really do need to go and see it. And of course, people are not dissimilar with their excuses about coming to church. You know, we might invite someone to come along to church and their first response might be, oh, yes, I'd love to. Thank you so much for inviting me. And then when the weekend rolls round and they don't show up, you might contact them just to see if they were all right, if everything's okay. And they might say the equivalent of, oh, I'm so sorry. I couldn't come. I just bought a house and I had to go and see it. Oh, I'm so sorry that the house was in such a mess. I couldn't come. And, you know, the dog did it. The dog made the house such a mess. See, that's the idea that's being communicated in this story. They said yes, but they're now turning the invitation down. But they're ever so nice about it. But they're still saying no. They're rejecting this second invitation. Now, here's the second excuse. And it's that the person's career is more important than God. Verse 19. Another said, I have brought five yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please, excuse me. Now again, either this chap is a complete fool or he's a blatant liar. Buying animals without testing them first. What if they're sick? What if they're maimed? You see, would you purchase a car without testing it first? Taking it on a test drive? Wouldn't it make you rather suspicious if you were looking at a used car and you asked the salesman, well, can I take it out for a spin? And the salesman says, oh, no, you can't do that. You probably say, well, is the car in good working order? And the salesman says, oh, yes, it is. And it's not unreasonable to ask, is it? Can I take it on a test drive? And if you're still told, well, sorry, sir, you can't do that, it would make you very suspicious, wouldn't it? That's the picture here. This man has brought animals without first testing them. And what would you use oxen for? Well, you use it to plough your field and to make a living. So it was in effect his work, his career, that kept him back from God. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong about a career. A career is challenging, it can be rewarding and fulfilling and worthwhile. And the fact is that Christians should be among the hardest working of all people. And whatever your profession is, whether or not you're the head of a large corporation, or whether you're working in McDonald's, whether you're a university professor, or you're cleaning the streets, whatever you do should be done to the glory of God, and to do it well, and to work hard at it. We know that the Bible says that if a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. So the Bible doesn't encourage us to be lazy. It encourages us to work hard and to be diligent. The Bible also says if you don't provide for your own home, you're worse than an infidel. So the Bible is clearly not critical of a man or a woman having a career and making a good living. That's not the issue here. The issue is that this man placed his career as being more important than God. If advancing our career becomes more important than advancing our spiritual life, then something is out of kilter. We haven't got things in the proper order and in the right perspective. Now we have excuse number three. This is where relationships are more important than God. So in verse 20, another said, I just got married, so I can't come. Now, in contrast to the other two men who offered excuses, this guy isn't even polite. In the original language, the response is rather blunt. The first chap says, look, I'm so sorry I can't come. The second says, please excuse me. But this one says something like, I'm not coming, so just go away. I've just got married. And you wonder, well, don't you think your wife would have liked a nice meal? You know, the man goes home to his new wife and says, darling, guess what? You don't have to cook tonight. Get your glad rags on. We've been invited to a royal feast, which, by the way, we've already agreed to go to. Be like getting an invitation for a banquet at Buckingham Palace. Surely that would have been a great opportunity. So you can see how all of this would have been offensive to make an excuse not to go. Now what we're seeing here is that the first man was possessed by his possessions. The second man is preoccupied by his career. But here is a person who allows human affection to keep him from God. Now this is a tricky one, isn't it? Because what's more virtuous or more commendable than the love of a husband for a wife and a wife for a husband? And certainly Jesus is not putting down relationships, but the reality is that this man was allowing this to be an excuse to keep him from God. And again, we will even offer excuses after we've become a Christian. Oh, I can't go to church today because it's too hot. I can't go to church today because it's too cold. Well, actually, I think it's going to rain. It's going to be dark when the service is finished. So I can't go. And at the end of the day, they're all excuses, not reasons. Just think for a moment the commitment that sports fans have. You know, one dark, cold, windy, raining Sunday morning, just after we had moved house, I went out to put some rubbish in the bin and a neighbour appeared. And he was dressed as if he was going to the Antarctic. And I asked him, where are you going? And he said, well, I'm off to see West Ham play at the Olympic Stadium. And he said to me, you know, I'm going to be frozen, it's going to be wet, and I'm probably going to be disappointed at the result, but you know what? I wouldn't miss it. Wouldn't miss it. I wonder if that's how we feel about coming to church. No excuses. I wouldn't miss it. Wouldn't miss it. You know, a true football supporter will support their team no matter what the weather conditions are, no matter what the circumstances are, they will root their team on. They'll dress in the team colours, and when the team scores a goal, they're screaming and yelling and waving their arms in excitement. And they'll remember all of the scores of their team's games going back 20 years. And they'll still talk about that great game when they won the cup. What if people were like that at church? Never miss a service, never miss an opportunity to worship, were enthusiastic about worshipping God, would talk to one another for years after the great services they've attended. But what if people offered the same reasons that they offer for not going to church, for why they don't go to football games anymore? You ever thought how stupid it would sound? So a friend asks, well, you don't go to football games anymore then. You're such a fan. Why have you stopped going? Well, you know, all the people that sit around me didn't seem to be that friendly. Well, there wasn't that many people at the game last week, so I've decided not to go again. You know, the seats were so hard and uncomfortable. Yeah, it was so difficult for me to find a parking place. Well, I stopped going because the coach never came and personally visited me. I don't go to football games anymore because I don't like to watch all of those replays on the big video screen that they have up in the stadium. I don't go to games anymore because I want to do other things. Do you know what? My parents took me to a lot of football games when I was young, so I don't feel I need to go anymore. Well, I read a book on football. Now I know all there is about it. I don't need to go and see a game anymore. And yet those are all things people will say about church. And it's rather funny, isn't it, when you apply it to a football game. And you know, people will offer up excuses as to why they don't read the Bible. You know, I'm too busy. I just can't find time to read the Bible. Well, the Bible is so long, I just don't know where to start. Or, I did read it in church last week, so that's enough, isn't it? All of those are excuses and not reasons. It all depends on our perspective, doesn't it? We will make time for what is important and what is interesting to us. We'll find time to read the newspaper. We'll find time to watch our favourite TV programme. We'll find time to go on the web and spend hours doing absolutely nothing. We find time to be on our phones constantly. And yet we don't have time to open up the Word of God and let it speak to us. But Jesus is telling us here, look, don't make excuses, but find the time for things that really matter. Now, what's the antidote to this? Well, in Luke's version of the story, immediately on the heels of this parable, Jesus says this, verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. That's pretty hard language, isn't it, from Jesus? Some of the most controversial words he ever spoke. If you come after me and don't hate your father and mother and wife and brother and sister and husband and your children, well, what? God telling us now that we're to hate our family? But we need to put it in context, don't we? After all, husbands and wives are commanded to love one another in Ephesians chapter 5. In the same way that Christ loves the church. So surely husbands are now not told to hate their wives. What does Jesus mean when he says the word hate? Well, it could probably be translated better. The meaning here is to love less by comparison. And so a better translation would be, you must love God more than your husband, more than your wife, more than your children and your parents, so much so that your love for people and things would be like hatred in comparison to your love for God. And you know, the incredible thing is, if you really love God as you ought to, you'll find yourself having much more love for your wife and much more love for your husband and much more love for your children and your parents than you would have had before. But it's getting our priorities in order. That's the idea that's being communicated here. And a disciple, which comes from the very root of the word discipline, means make time for what is important. And so in contrast to the people in this story who offer up their excuses, a disciple makes time for church, makes time for studying the Word of God, makes time for prayer, makes time for all of the things that Christians should be doing. But you know, there's a final movement in this story which is really quite fascinating. Go back to Matthew 22 and verse 11. The king has sent out his servants to the highways and he's asked them to bring in everybody that's there because the original invitees have refused to come. And so in they come. And in verse 11, when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there who was not wearing wedding clothes. And he asked him, how did you get in here without wedding clothes, friend? And the man was speechless. Now I think that the biggest challenge of being invited to a royal occasion, if you were invited to the wedding of Prince Harry, is what am I going to wear? Wouldn't that be a real challenge? What's the apparel? What's the dress code? Have you ever dressed inappropriately for something? You know, you didn't know that it was more formal than you thought, or maybe more casual than you thought. Reminds me of that Only Fools and Horses episode. Do you remember that with Del Boy and Rodney? They're invited to a fancy dress party at a friend's house. And so they decided that they will go as Batman and Robin. But unbeknown to them, the friend who had invited them had died the day before. And so all the guests turned up in rather somber attire in order to console the widow. But when Del Boy and Rodney arrive at the house, they charge into the living room. Na 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 na. Batman! only to be told by Trigger, "You didn't know he died then." A funny episode, but it left you cringing and thinking, how embarrassing. Now, there are two good reasons why anybody would not have a wedding garment at this banquet. Now, one possible reason, of course, is I didn't have one because I didn't have a chance to go home and get it. And the second reason is, well, I haven't got the right attire because I don't own it. But interestingly, the man in the story that Jesus gave doesn't say any either of those things. Why is that? Well, here's the reason. The original guests were invited ahead of time. And so if they decided to go at the second invitation, they would have been ready, they would have been prepared, and they would have had the right dress. They would have the right attire to go to a formal banquet. But when they refuse to come, the king's servants are told in verse 9, go onto the street corners, invite to the banquet anyone that you find. And so the servants went out into the streets, gathered all the people they could find, the bad as well as the good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. They weren't making reservations, they came in right off the street, where none of them could possibly have had their wedding garments with them. First, because they came right in, they didn't go home. And second, because many of them would have been quite poor and wouldn't have had a wedding garment. But you see the implication of that. For these people to be correctly dressed in the right wedding garments, it must have meant that the king would have provided the wedding garments himself at his own expense. The garment was issued at the front door. No cost to the person receiving the garment. So you didn't have to worry about, I can't come because I'm not dressed correctly. Don't worry, you're going to receive that upon arrival. And the servants would say, here is your wedding garment. What size are you? Here you go, put it on. And so everybody had the appropriate attire. And so this man couldn't say, I didn't have a chance to go and get one. Nobody had. He couldn't say, I don't own one. Very few of them would have done. He was going to be graciously given one free by the king. But this guy is the ultimate party crasher. He shows up and the servants say to him, here's your wedding garment, sir. And he says, oh, no, I don't want a wedding garment. Well, you are required to wear one, sir. Well, I don't care whether I'm required or not. I don't want to wear one. I'm going to wear whatever I want to wear. So just get out of my way. Let me get into the banquet. And as he walks in, he is sticking out like a sore thumb. And it's offensive to the host who sees this man who has ignored all of the protocol, broken all of the rules, and in effect has insulted the host. And you know, that's what happens when we say that I can get to God through my own good living and not by his grace. When we say that our good works are enough to get me into the kingdom, we're effectively saying that Jesus' death on the cross was a waste of time. And when we reject the full saving work of Christ and we feel free to add to it our own good works, we're in effect saying, I'm not going to wear the wedding garment provided by the king, I'm going to wear my own clothes. I'm going to come in on the basis of what I have and what I've done, not on what you are going to give me. You see, when we become believers in Jesus, we are clothed in the righteousness of Christ. We are now hidden with Christ in God. And so the idea here in this parable is, well, I don't want God's provision. I don't want God's forgiveness. I will go in on my own strength, on my own ability, on my own talents, on my own merit, and God will let me in. And the host says, what are you doing? Why did you come in here wearing this? And the man was speechless. No smug remarks, no comebacks. You see, the only way we're going to be admitted into the fullness of the kingdom of God is because we have taken God's provision of the wedding garment, God's gracious provision of forgiveness and reconciliation. You know, in every phase of life, there'll be something to distract us. You know, when we're young, we're too preoccupied with having fun. I'll get to God later. I've got all the years of my life ahead of me, or so we think. And then in adulthood, we say, well, I'm so busy now. I've got so many things going on. I've got all the bills to pay. I've got a family to raise, goals to reach. And then in later years, we're too old. Well, I'm so set in my ways, you know. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. And then as death approaches, we become too ill to think. Well, what are you saying? I can't hear you. See, that's why you and I need to get right with God now. Whatever stage of life we're at, don't wait for some point in the future which never comes. We need to believe in Jesus Christ. God has offered his forgiveness. And if we take it, if we grasp it, you know that the day will come when you'll be admitted into the wedding banquet and you'll be dressed in the right clothes. You'll be dressed in the clothes of Jesus. And you will be able to enjoy the blessings of all eternity because you were properly dressed. And Jesus Christ is using this illustration to point out how in dying, because of humankind's sin, forgiveness and mercy and grace has been given to all the world, the good and the bad. It's there for everyone. All are included. And Jesus is saying, all you have to do is don't make any excuses, but simply accept.